Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 666. Yeah, I know. Let's just look over that little issue. I'm Jim McDowell, and with me tonight, all the way from the UK, is Rich. Rich, how's it going over in the UK?
Good. Thanks, Jim. Yeah, all good here. Thank you.
So last we left, I think you were heading off to Silverstone for F1 weekend. Tell us how that was.
It was a wild weekend. It was packed house on the Sunday, 140,000 capacity crowd. Yeah, it was just an awesome race. I'm guessing quite a lot of people, even though we're on a MotoGP and bike racing podcast here, I'm guessing quite a lot of people will have seen it. I was lucky enough to be in the stand on the first turn at Abbey. And yeah, well, it was the crowd, the noise. It's the first time I've been to the F1 at Silverstone since 1999. And yeah, the atmosphere was absolutely incredible. It was a good race. I mean, obviously it was a little bit controversial on the first lap with Hamilton and Verstappen getting together. I can only hope that the MotoGP there at the end of August is going to be as good.
Hopefully. The thing that I noticed was the crowd. That was the one thing that, even though we have all this great racing, the crowd, just the noise that the crowd can make, that you can hear over top of Formula One cars, or you hear over top of MotoGP. When Russell did his qualifying lap in Q3, the whole crowd was just cheering the whole way through. And I thought, oh man, I had the hairs up on my arms just because we've been 18 months or so without crowds that can produce that kind of sound. So I just thought it was one of those things that said, hey, maybe we are really getting to the end of this, or maybe we're just getting to where we now know how to live with it.
And I guess, you know, we're on the other end of COVID now, so but Silverstone F1 is pretty much always a sold out event anyway. But as you say, I mean, you can hear the noise on the TV, which is quite unusual for a motorsport event, and certainly to be in the stands contributing to the noise as I was, it really was something to behold. It was really good. And as I say, I'm sure they'll have a not quite as big a crowd for MotoGP, I guess, but I think they normally have getting towards probably 100,000 in on the Sunday. So hopefully the atmosphere will be equally as good, and hopefully the weather will be as good, although probably not quite as good as it was for Silverstone weekend, because that was a very unusually hot sort of heat wave that we were experiencing for a week in the UK, which is atypical, but very nice anyway.
All right. Sounds like you had fun there. So if you like this kind of thing, hearing me and Rich talk about what it is that we do when we're not doing MotoGP, then kindly donate to the show. Go over to www.motopodcast.com. You'll find links to PayPal and Patreon. Every little bit helps cover server cost and other things. Keeps the lights on, keeps everything running. And if you really, really like the show, go over to iTunes. Give us a little bit of a shout there. Give us some love with a good review. And hopefully we'll have more people who will like the show and come to it. And with that, we have fans who have written in. Rich, tell us who's written in.
Yeah, well, we had an email from Keith Kovac, who's a fairly regular contributor to the show. And the point he raised was, it seems ever since Danny Pedrosa left the team, anyone not named Marc Marquez has shown how flawed the Honda is. With the World Superbike team not doing well, along with the slump in MotoGP, what does Honda need to do to get back up to the front? KTM was able to make the adjustment to get back up front, and I would have thought Honda would have been able to do the same, since they are the largest manufacturer. Discuss. So, Jim, I think we both have a view on this.
Yeah.
My response to Keith, it's a great question, as usual. My response was that I think probably Honda's problem, at least in part, is due to their sheer critical mass as a company, which is to say that, are they quick enough to react to the changes that are needed? And they have clearly built a bike all around one rider, certainly in the last few years, in the shape of Marc Marquez. And we know that he is able to do things with a bike which other riders on that Honda have not been able to replicate. And once they lost him due to that nasty crash in Jerez last year, their form disappeared very, very rapidly. So it's really shown up a problem that I think everybody knew existed, which was that without Marquez on board, they've got some problems.
Mm-hmm. All right. I looked at it this way. You tell me a Honda that actually did handle. You go back in history and find me one. There really isn't one, okay?
We've seen the pictures, haven't we, of the 500s, you know, high siding riders off and being vicious. I mean, those 500 NSRs were renowned for being lethal. Maybe it is an endemic problem. It's part of the DNA of the way their bikes are designed and built, perhaps. I'm not an expert. You're much more of an expert on this than I am, Jim. You can only report on what you see. But, clearly, I mean, okay, fair enough. Crutchlow had a couple of solid wins on the bike and was very fast on his day, but was more often than not chewing gravel with the front going from underneath him. And that seems to be the big problem. And we see it with Pol this year, kind of struggling to find setup on that bike. And yeah, kind of all at sea. And Honda in World Superbike is a bit of a horror show, really, for as long as I can remember. I think you probably have to go back to
Toesland 2009, Tenkata.
Yeah. I was going to say Vermeulen, but yeah, Toesland was after him. And ever since, really, it's been, you know, the accusation was always that HRC weren't terribly interested in World Superbike, and therefore Honda weren't really putting in an awful lot of R&D to that series, and they seem to be trying to put more into it, but without results.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things here. Let's kind of go back to the Honda and their time in MotoGP / 500s. Like, really, the last frame that actually probably handled was Spencer's 250 in 1985. You know, if you've heard that interview that I did with him, Freddie loved that bike. That bike was an amazing bike. It handled extremely well. He loved that thing. They tried to use a lot of what was in that bike in the onward moving with the 500s. It just never worked because the engines are just too volatile. The way it develops its power is completely different. So the ideas that were there probably didn't work over that. So along the way, you had guys that basically could just ride over top of anything and be fast. Doohan, Spencer, Lawson would talk about the fact, and he won his title in 89. He had to crank the steering dampener to full-on power, and you held on for dear life. So it was never easy for anybody to really ride a Honda. But to the point with them being able to change, you can't change an aluminum-framed bike as quickly as you can change a steel-framed bike like KTM has. So with KTM having a steel frame, they've got some jigs that are probably set up in the workshop. They can take any frame, cut it, bend it, heat it, bend it, put it back together again, and it's going to be as strong, it's going to be as durable, it's going to be what they want it to be. You can get a couple guys that can weld one of those up in a couple days. If you look at the aluminum framed bikes that we have today, there are pieces of basically wrought aluminum that are machined. There's pieces that have to be cast. There's all that then has to be welded together. You know, like the side beams are extruded and they're very thin. Well, if you want to change the flex that happens on those two beams, you have to change the thickness of those beams. To do that, you either got to weld something to it to change its sort of its natural frequency and stiffen it, or if you're the wrong way around and you got to take something out of it, what are you going to do? You really can't drill holes in it to produce more flex. Then you're going to have to weld it all up again. And aluminum is a funny material to weld. If you just throw a ton of heat at it in one area, you will warp and twist and bend that chassis around. So there has to be a weld plan that says, okay, we're going to do, you know, the casting here where the swing arm pivot is. Okay, now we're going to do some tacks. Now we're going to move over here, do something with the triple tree. Then we're going to move over to a different spot and weld something else. And it just takes a whole lot more time than what they had. Also, I don't think Honda has really ever really listened to a rider. Maybe only Spencer, and that was back because Spencer and Mr. Honda had a relationship where they were on the same playing field. And really, Honda, once Mr. Honda had passed away, it was not the same company that it was back then. And so it's always been an engineering company. It always will be an engineering company. So they're trying to design solutions for whatever it is. And their solutions are based on going fast and motors and how the interface. I mean, you take any Honda car, the most important thing about that car is how does the driver interface to that engine and that car and that feedback?
Yeah.
I'm lucky enough to have one of the new Civic Type R's, and that car is phenomenal with its feedback and what it tells you through the steering wheel, through the pedals, and through your backside. It's amazing. Everything else on it, kind of junk. But that part of it's really, really good. So that part of it. The thing with Honda not liking World Superbike, Honda did like World Superbike, right? They built the RC30. They won the first two World Superbike titles with Freddie Merkel on the Rumi Hondas. They, had good show there. They won on the RC45 with Kaczynski. And then they realized they really couldn't, the way the rules got shifted, Twins got 1,000 cc's, Fours had 750, Ducati kind of got away with, stole the march on everything, right? Their bike was superior. So yep. Honda said, we'll just build our own V-twin. They did. It was very successful in Colin Edwards' hands. I mean, that was probably the most titanic struggle for a world championship that I can think of that I've ever watched was Edwards and Bayless in 2002. So Honda has put money into World Superbike. However, when MotoGP came out in 2002 with four strokes, Honda was like, nope, don't have to go play in World Superbike anymore. We're going to go play over here in our chosen Grand Prix action, which is the pinnacle. Sorry, World Superbike fans, I love the racing, but it's not the pinnacle of what we have. And so they spent their money over there. And they, why not? Because you could develop anything you wanted over there. You didn't have to start. You weren't confined with a street bike chassis that you could weld some stuff to if you wanted to, or do different little things. You could build your own frame any which way you want it. You could have all the electronics that you wanted. I mean, now we're into the Magneti Morellis and stuff. And so you could argue, are we really gaining anything there? But the cost is like anything else. It was going to be astronomical. And a worldwide recession never helped the situation either, or any of that. So the point of all that is that Honda simply has the best riders who can ride above and beyond whatever that motorcycle is that they give them. Now, I think Mark can guide them in the right direction, but him being absent for so long, Honda just stopped developing what they were doing and went in a different way, and that is to go back and pray at the altar of speed and just build a powerful motorcycle that goes really, really fast. But I was really shocked by the fact this year that Jenny Anderson had came onto the scene. She came from KTM. She's the one who's sort of the wizard of suspension and front end feel that somehow KTM has. Steel chassis. And, she is working hard to make that bike better. And you can see that it's better with Mark on it. But Mark has got the same problem that Pol has, that Cal has, that everybody has. And so Honda's going to have to address it. They've had 5 weeks. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see a new frame or pieces of a frame or an old frame, a 2019 frame or something show up for Mark to work on. But the 2019 frame may not play nicely with the new set of Michelin fronts that we have. There's a lot there because it isn't, and that's the other thing I really think it's inside of this too, is it isn't just a chassis. It is also the tires and how the tires affect the chassis.
So there's so many variables.
Yeah.
So many variables now, aren't there?
Yeah. It's a Rubik's Cube.
Yeah.
Right? It's like trying to figure that out. Ooh, I got one side. Ah, crap. Now the other side's terrible. I solve the front end problem. Well, I can't get Michelin to make me a slick to solve the rear problem because I have one slick that's not one slick, but one construction, one compound that's for everyone. And it's sort of, that same thing happens in Formula One with the standard tires. It happens in World Superbike with the Pirellis. So it's kind of normal for that to have an issue and go along there. So,
and we see, the other point, I suppose, in all of this is that we see with the rules now, which are quite prescriptive and constrictive at the same time, that the evolution of changes, that, the life cycle of adapting a bike or a car, whatever it is, runs over several seasons very often. So if you're in big, look at Yamaha. Okay, they're very competitive again this year, but that we were really sort of lambasting them over the recent seasons about the fact that they just could not get on top of the electronics issues, as well as probably some other things as well. There are so many variables, and in Honda's case as well, it's not been helped by the fact that Mark comes back, but nobody really knows how fit he actually is and how strong he is, and whether he's going to be riding that bike to its full capability. But the fact remains that if it's back to full strength Mark on a Honda that he likes, can anybody else ride it? That's Honda's problem, because what's to say he doesn't have another tumble and then he's out again for a few races or longer. So I don't know what Honda's solution to this problem is, but it's going to take them a long time to solve it. I think that's self-evident.
Yeah, Yamaha took a long time, but is Yamaha out of the woods? Because the only guy who can ride that bike is Quartararo. they're sort of in the same place. Quartararo has, is again another one of these talents who can ride beyond what's given to him and be fast. And Skyler and I talked about this, was the fact that Quartararo rides the Yamaha in a very different way as opposed to the other Yamaha riders. He gets in there deep on the brakes, hits it hard, squishes the front, lets go of the brakes, lets the tire reform, and tucks it in and goes to the apex. And he's fast. And, you know, I don't, Rossi doesn't ride that way. Morbidelli doesn't ride that way. And nor does Vinales. So, that's just where that is. All right, let's finish up his last little bit that he's got here, Rich.
Jim and I sent out some replies to Keith, and he came back to say, I've heard this kind of an argument before. When Yamaha had massive issues a few years ago, it took a long time to make the right adjustments, which is what we were just saying. He says, mainly due to Japanese manufacturers having a hard time admitting mistakes, which I think we know culturally, the Japanese, the hierarchical system that they have, I think it's not too contentious to say that change comes fairly slowly through those companies. I do hope they can make the transition quickly with Mark, because he's still not 100%, and it's not outside the realm of possibility that the Honda will be one of the worst bikes on the grid next year. I mean, okay, that's a pretty contentious thing to say. And I wouldn't want to be a fly on the wall at Honda if Aprilia comes out better than they do. And Aprilia, again, another good example of a much, much smaller factory, which has its own problems, I suppose. Aprilia's woes over recent years are fairly well known as well. But the smaller factories, and I suppose Ducati is perhaps a good example of this as well, that they can make changes quite quickly, although it's taken Ducati an awfully long time to get to a fairly competitive bike such as the one that they have now. It's still not, arguably not the best bike on the grid, but it's a pretty all-round package. So the Honda conundrum goes on, and I guess we'll see how things develop as the second half of the season kicks in, starting this weekend with the Styrian Grand Prix, I think is what we're calling this one.
I think it's Styrian, yes, that's right.
So, followed week after by the Austrian Grand Prix.
Yep. So that's the feedback. And Keith, thanks for writing in, and hopefully you enjoyed the replies that Rich and I gave you. Hopefully everybody else got a little something out of this too, because it did lead to some really great thought, and hopefully a great conversation between Rich and myself here. So with that, why don't we turn our attention to the little bit of news that we have from this past few weeks, and really not much going on, but we do know that Danny Pedrosa will ride the races in Austria as a wild card. Your thoughts on this, Rich? Anything?
I think you touched on it when we spoke a couple of weeks ago, Jim, which is to say, or certainly I've read since as well, that it's good that Pedrosa's back. It's good for the good for the series. I think from KTM's point of view, it's important for him to have some race experience to gauge his speed, so that as a test rider, he knows what level he needs to be operating at, because he's been out of the series for a few years now. And okay, he's going to be a great development rider, but if he's going two seconds a lap slower, which I'm not suggesting that he is, but if he was, then arguably that would create some different problems for KTM in terms of bike development. So it's going to be an interesting experiment, I suppose, for both KTM and for Danny himself, to match himself against a grid most of which he hasn't raced against before. I don't think we can really expect too much of him in terms of fighting for a podium or anything like that, but it will be interesting to see if he can mix it in the midfield.
Yeah, I think you're right with what you said. Do not expect Pedrosa to be fighting for a podium. Do not expect him to get out of Q1. He is going to learn what it's going to take to ride with these guys. He's going to see how fast they truly are, and he's going to look at what he needs to do or what areas he'll have to focus on, because you can follow another rider, even if it's only for a few seconds. You can see how Marquez or Quartararo are getting into a corner. You can see how the Yamaha is getting out of the corner. You can see how the Ducatis are doing it. And if you know what they're doing and when they pick up the gas and when they don't pick up the gas and things like that, you go back and race that, because they use that track for their testing for KTM. He'll be able to have a real good comparison of where he is, where he needs to work on the bike. And maybe he's 2 seconds slower than everybody, if he becomes a half a second quicker, in testing, then that bike's probably now maybe 0.7 to a full second quicker. Yeah. So good for that. Well, so we'll go to the next bit of news, and that is that Cal Crutchlow will replace Frank Morbidelli at Petronas for the next couple of rounds as well. It's basically Cal's bike until Morbidelli is well enough to, from his knee injury, to ride again. Again, this is good. Cal gets a chance as test rider for Yamaha to do the same things that Pedrosa is doing, although obviously Cal has not been out of the series as long as Pedrosa had been. But again, it's that same concept there. So don't expect anything magical out of Crutchlow. Although you got to think Cal's just going to chuck it at least once or twice to the gravel, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah. My understanding is that he'll do the two races in Austria, and he's also going to do Silverstone as well, which from a British perspective is obviously going to be great.
Yes.
And probably won't do too much damage to the last minute ticket sales.
No, not at all. And let's see, that's another bit of news. We have the construction of the new Mandalika, I hope that's how you say it, circuit that is in Indonesia is set to host World Superbike in 2021 and MotoGP in 2022. It's 80% complete, and they expect to have homologation by the end of this month. So they're looking to have that race there. And so, as I know, I think World Superbike goes there, and then MotoGP races are going to be there as well. So another new racetrack for us to see. We have still not seen the Kimi Ring yet, so
worst luck. Yeah, I was looking forward to that race. That looks like a good track.
I will say this, Formula One's going to Zandvoort. Yeah, I know it's not a Formula One show, but that track's very interesting, and its layout and in the dunes. I would love to see MotoGP go there. I'm not too sure that they could do it now with that bank turn that they put in, but I mean, they could make some different chicane, or you know, put a different pass through there for the bikes to go through. I'd like to see it if they could get it homologated to the standard for MotoGP. I'd like to see them go there.
I don't know if they actually, I don't think I've ever seen a bike race at Zandvoort. I'm sure there must have been one, or at least national level, but I've never seen an international bike race at Zandvoort. So yeah, it would be interesting, because it is a good track for people like us who you know, got long memories. The original track was pretty extreme, and the modern version is, like many of the tracks nowadays, a bit of a cut down travesty to what it once was. But nevertheless, it would be good to see them going back there. One other piece of news, Jim, that I read today, which again goes back to what we were talking about on the show a couple of weeks ago, and that is that this weekend Suzuki will be debuting their shapeshifter device.
Ooh, excellent.
Long overdue from their point of view, and let's see, you know, what kind of benefits, or, you know, again, you know, you might solve one problem and create several other problems that you didn't figure on. The law of unintended consequences sometimes applies, but they do need that, because everybody else has it. You know, I profess my view that I don't like these devices very much, and once everybody's got them, ban them, because what benefit do they bring other than making the bikes look ugly?
Yes.
Going down the straights. But anyway, again, contentious, but at least Suzuki have one now, so we'll see how Rins and Mir fare.
If it gives them the speed that everyone says that they're missing, Rins is probably going to wind up being very near the podium, and hopefully he can qualify better, because he has, in my mind, he has ridden superbly in defense of his championship. It's just the bike is not there. But then again, Suzuki wins a world title like, what, once every 20 years or so? Just something rough.
Kenny... 93. Kenny Jr.
93, 2000.
2000, yeah. It's the last time. Yeah. So it's long overdue. Well, last year's was long overdue, but they're clearly not going to win it this year. But hopefully this device, if these awful things are going to stay in the series, then maybe it puts them in a better position for next year, because probably the points gap is too big now. But one of the things I'm interested to see, because I am a big Rins fan, is whether or not having that device, if it's you know, gives them that extra oomph out of the corners and means they're not having to gain everything back on the turns, whether he stops crashing on the front end. Because he's only really started to do that badly this season, I believe. He has been guilty in the past of chucking away good positions, but not with the regularity that it's happened this year. And I do hope and believe that it's more to do with the fact that he's just chasing the lap time because of that lack of straight line performance coming out of the turns compared to everybody else, and he's been trying to gain it back on the brakes, and ultimately, because he has that quite upright style as well, quite a front-endy style, I just wonder if that's been causing his problems. So again, second half of the season for Rins is really critical, I think, because he's got some reputational damage to repair.
Yep, you're right about that one. I hope so, for Rin's sake, but I'm not so sure. I am not that big of a fan of Rin's. I think he has mental lapses that are just far too often for my taste. I mean, for the elite, yes, everyone makes a mistake. Okay, and it's easy for me to sit here in armchair of this, but I had my fair share of trying to go too fast and fall off and whatnot. So I see that in Rins, and I hopefully this proves me wrong, because I like the guy. I think he's, you know, fabulous, but you're right. I think he's sort of riding for his job for some extent.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into the very last bit of our news that's there, and this is the reason why we're really here for this show, is for this. From Motorsports Magazine, Matt Oxley had an article that was dealing with how young is too young to race 130-mile-an-hour Moto3 motorcycle. This was brought on because of the death of Hugo Milan, who was killed in Aragon a couple weeks ago now, I think, from here. So I figured that Rich and I would like to have we've had safety talks before, but let's have a talk about what an age requirement is required for it. Now, we've had Hugo Milan, who's there, who has there. We had Justin DuPasqui, who lost his life in Italy this year. And, you know, I can go back to Indy in, I want to say, 2009 or 10, when Peter Lenz died at the Speedway, which is the first Speedway death in a long time there. And the interesting thing about it, each one of these was on basically a Moto3 motorcycle. They all capable of doing about 130 miles an hour when geared correctly. And each one of these was an accident that happened in a pack with other riders nearby and with another rider hitting a downed rider. So the question then is, should 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old kids, really kids, be allowed to race these motorcycles? Matt makes the argument that it used to be 18 years old before you could move into the world championship, and it was like 16, I think, for national series kind of a thing. I know here in the States that you can't do road racing until you're 15 with WIRA. You couldn't do road racing unless you were 16 with the AMA. You couldn't get a professional license until you were 16. And then for my case, I was a rookie novice. Then you got enough points, you then became a junior. This is in the dirt track circles I'm talking about here. And then once you were a junior and you had enough points, you could turn and become expert. And basically, the question is like, are these kids too young? So let's just start there, Rich. Is 12, 13 years old too young to be racing a motorcycle at 130 miles an hour?
Yes.
Okay.
I personally, as a father of children, now they're not racing bikes, but personally, I think there are so many things that you are not allowed to legally do at that age. Well, pretty much everything. You're considered to be a minor. It changes from country to country, of course, and in the USA, it changes from state to state. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
From a UK perspective, you know, you can't buy a beer in a pub until you're 18. You can't take your provisional driving license or start driving a car on the road until you're 17. You can ride a bike on the road, but not until you're 16. So I think it's like everything in the world, really, and certainly with regards to sport, all sports have just got younger and younger and younger. You know, we've got people winning Olympic medals today who are, you know, in their early teens, for example. And that's great, you know, and we don't wish to stop young kids having the ability to go and do the things that they want to do. But my take on this is that there's reputational damage to the sport that starts to occur when you have very young, well, adolescents, let's say, being killed in a very public forum now, because all of this stuff, whether you can shout the rights and wrongs of this or not, but this stuff immediately gets posted online, is available for the whole world to see. It's very unedifying. And I just think we're at a stage now with social media and you know, the fact that all of this stuff gets broadcast now. Does the sport really want to be associated with this kind of death toll? Because there was also Andreas Pereth, who was also 14, a couple of years ago. I think that was an accident in Spain again. Nothing against Spain, but I was watching the National Series kind of Moto3. It's the Talent Cup, they call it here, which is one of the kind of complementary race series to the British Superbikes. So I happened to be watching it on Sunday. They were racing at Thruxton. And I mean, I'm not going out on a limb here. I think there were some 12-year-olds racing in that. I mean, literally some of them with a crash helmet on who looked like space aliens, because they're so small that with a crash helmet on, they look completely, you know, abnormal in a way, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, these kids can hardly touch the ground when they're sat on the bike. And because they require parental consent to be allowed to race, you just have to start asking the question, is that really a situation that is correct? And I'm just not sure that it is. But this can only be solved, I believe, by the governing body stepping in and saying, this is a problem. We need to sort this out. And if they came across and said all the national, and I believe, you know, the FIM, as the sort of the international body, I think they have at least some power of jurisdiction to the national bodies to say, look, we want to implement a minimum age here. Yes, the kids can ride, you know, mini moto or various other forms of much lower speed competitive bike racing, fine. But if you are going to jump onto, you know, a bike that, as we say, is capable of 130 miles an hour, and not just that, I mean, this argument that we've been hearing recently about Moto3, and it's also the same in, well, what they're calling Supersport 300 still in World Superbikes, although those bikes have got bigger in terms of engine capacity. You know, there is so much depth of field now and such equality in the machinery that the packs that they're racing in now are vastly bigger than would have been the case even, say, 5 or 10 years ago, but certainly 10 years ago, where you had a big disparity in the quality of machinery, not the quality of talent necessarily, but certainly of machinery, so that fields tended to get more spread out between the haves and the have-nots. Whereas now, you know, bikes don't break down, the engineering of them is absolutely exemplary in most cases, and therefore they race very closely, lap after lap after lap. And we were having this discussion a couple of weeks ago, Jim, about the fact that Moto3 at Grand Prix level has become, you know, a massive disaster just waiting to happen, and nobody really quite knows how to figure it out. And it's certainly not the case that, you know, as you mentioned, Dufasquier, difficult name to say, who was, you know, tragically killed in Mugello this year, it's still going to happen. I mean, it's a dangerous sport. You can make it safer, but you can't make it safe. But at least in his case, he was 20, so he was perfectly capable to make that decision for himself. And I just think it's tarnishing the sport to see youngsters being killed like that. And to the point, and it should never really be about this, but our sport lives off funding from sponsors and so on. We will get to the situation before much longer if this carries on where, you know, headline sponsor companies don't want to be associated with this anymore. And then, you know, what does that mean for the future?
Yeah, I mean, great points all the way around there, Rich. I agree with you. I mean, sponsors are will step back and go, hey, look, we have a problem here. And that is, we do not want to be associated with the death of a 13, 14, 15-year-old kid. Does Red Bull want to be a part of that? Probably not. I don't think DD Majestics is going to let that happen. Would Nike want to be a part of it? No. Would Coca-Cola want to be a part of it? No. We're not allowed tobacco money anymore, so the money's got to come from somewhere. And a lot of this is that these kids that are coming up are under an enormous amount of pressure to have some kind of handshake, closet in the drawer signed agreement that, hey, I'm going to ride on Grassini's Moto 3 team or with, Patronus or, I'm trying to think of one of the other, the KTM IO boys, the Tech 3 boys. And they're fighting for this at this point. And there's this huge pressure on this 13, 14-year-old to be able to perform at this level. I think you saw a little bit of that at, like, the Olympics. There was the one gymnast from the United States. She didn't participate in a few things. And we found out that there was a family problem that happened, which was another form of pressure that was on her that she couldn't deal with. And it's too much. There was a diver who on a springboard didn't get her bounce right and went in feet first on the world stage.
Yep.
So there's an immense amount of pressure that these kids are feeling. And a lot of that's put onto them because the parents are putting all this money into this. I remember Randy Mamola talking to us at the GP at Indianapolis. I'm going to say somewhere in that 2010, 2011 range. I don't remember exactly the year, but he said that his boy Dakota was trying to get a Moto 3 ride. And they said, if don't even come talk to us if you don't have €100,000.
Yeah.
€100,000. That's a hell of a lot of money. I mean, that's, I don't know. If I translate €100,000 into US dollars, that's a really nice house here in the US. I'm pretty sure it's probably a nice house anywhere in Europe. But the point of it is that the parents are, and I've seen this where the parents are putting so much pressure on the kid to succeed. I've seen kids that were great at racing a motorcycle and having fun, and their parents would be like, well, you realize you did this, you were, a half a second per lap slower than you were in your heat race. You realize that? Tracks change, things change, bike change, tires are more worn. Who knows what those things are? But they're berating their kid that they should be going faster. And I'm not trying to put the blame on the parents here, but there's also that component of it. I've seen kids here in the United States, they go to Loretta Lynn's for motocross. That's where all of the big factory teams are, and they want to look at who is the next up-and-coming kid. And these kids are dealing with the pressures of essentially adult life at 12. I've seen kids at racetracks that are 6 or 7 years old, and they get done banging bars with somebody, and the next thing you know, they got their Tonka truck out and the shovel, and they're playing in the dirt because they're six, which is, so I'm not sure where this needs to be because I have no idea, but I am going to talk to somebody who has an idea about it from a mental health, from a physicality standpoint, and that's Dr. Claire McDowell. So we will have her interview after Rich and I are done here talking. So stay tuned for that. I'm sure that's going to be very interesting for all of us to learn something from that. But let's think about it this way. Again, you said it, is that you're not allowed to drive a car till you're at least 15 and you have a parent in the car with you here in the U.S., at least in the state that I'm in. I think it varies a little bit. It can be as low as 14 because I came from a state that you could be 14 and do that, but you had to be like 14 and a half and your birthday was coming, etc. There were some vagaries around that set of rules. You cannot vote legally in the United States in any election until you're 18. You can't drink in the U.S. until you're 21. And you can't even have beer anymore. You used to be able to have, like, they called it 3-2 beer here in the U.S. This is long before I was ever of drinking age. And people had did that. So I think it's probably behooves the racing bodies to look at it from that standpoint. Like, okay, if a governmental body who essentially is in charge of the well-being of the populace says you can't have a 2-ton car that can go 100 miles an hour until you're 18, well, then maybe that you shouldn't have a motorcycle that can go 130 until you're 16, perhaps, maybe something to that nature. So there's that element to it. But there's also a different element to it, and that's maybe the physical size. You know, at 12 years old, you're 13 years old, you get your puberty spurt, you grow, you gain some mass on your body, you gain strength, you have all those things there. Maybe some of these kids at those ages aren't physically strong enough to handle a bike that can go that fast. For me, one of the things that was amazing is I thought I was in really good shape having raced dirt track for years until I got on a road racer. I couldn't believe the pressure that was in my forearms. I couldn't believe the fatigue I had in my back, my shoulders. It was amazing. And the first race that I raced, I was doing a 20 lap Wira endurance race, and I got to about lap 15 and pulled off. My dad comes running up to the bike. He goes, "What's wrong with the bike? What's wrong with the bike?" I said, "There's nothing wrong with this bike. I can't ride any farther because my arms are jello. I have shooting pains in my shoulders. I am now becoming a hazard, not only to myself, but to the other people who are around me for this." And he's like, "Okay, we'll park the bike." And that was one of the things that my parents were very much supportive of. If we got to a racetrack where I did not feel comfortable with what we were doing, didn't matter. My dad, didn't matter how much gas money we spent, how much money we spent on the bike that week. Dad's like, "If you don't want to race this, you put that on that stand and I'm thinking no less of you. We'll put it back in the truck and we'll go home." And I did that on one occasion.
I'm not sure that's how the majority, well, I'm sure there's so much pressure, as you said. And let's not forget, these bikes are getting faster every year. They break down less, as we said earlier on. You know, these races are long and these kids are too young. And I just think in a civilized society, you have anarchy unless you have structure. And the structure comes from rules. And it used to be the case, as Matt Oxley pointed out, and I can't say I was necessarily aware of this myself until I read it, that the minimum age limit in the international series, at least, was 18. And I really think it's beholden upon whether it's Dorna as the rights holder or the FIM as the sanctioning body of world motorcycle racing to say, we have a problem there. We kind of have a perfect storm of lots of money in the sport, many wealthy parents who can fund getting very young children into sport, this massive pressure to succeed at the earliest possible age, otherwise your career's over at 13. And let's be honest, I mean, we were all young once. You know, you lack imagination in your teens, and particularly in your early teens, as to what can go wrong. Matt Oxley, in this article, made the very salient point that in the Mugello weekend, you know, DuPasquier was killed on the Saturday, tragically. On the first lap of the Moto3 race the following morning, six riders went down on the first lap. So, you know, the lights go green and they're in racing mode, and you can't blame them for that. You just have to put some checks and balances into the system to say we perhaps just need a little bit more maturity here. And again, although it shouldn't be the determining part of the argument, we need to have some sanity for the good of the series in terms of its reputation on the world stage, which is that we don't want, you know, on, because it's not going to be long before, you know, something disastrous happens in a Moto3 race, you know, the way things are going on the world stage, live feed beamed worldwide. I mean, cast your mind back to May 94 when Senna was killed, you know, at Imola on live TV. That was a fundamental paradigm shift in well, motorsport across the piece, I would suggest, certainly in terms of car racing, and massive changes happen very, very quickly. And we don't really want to get to that stage again where we have a 10 rider pile up in Moto3 or any of the other series for that matter, and a couple of kids getting hit by errant bikes, because it's not, you know, we rarely see people getting seriously damaged these days by, you know, hitting guardrails or trees. Those days, thankfully, are long gone. But in bike racing, you know, all of these incidents that we're seeing in recent years are due to bikes hitting riders or other bikes hitting riders who have already gone down. And I don't see how that can really be stopped as a risk, unless we're going to go back to a kind of a three division series where you have the front boys on very good machinery, the rest in the mid pack on poor, you know, poorer machinery, and then the have nots at the back with you know, who are just wobbling around because that's all they've got. And I don't think that's a solution either.
Right. You know, if you want to think about it, you think about what happened with Simicelli. That was a live broadcast in the premier class. Yeah. What happened? Hit by another bike in close proximity. Okay. Why? Because he was trying to save a crash that had already happened, yet he continued with it. Okay, I don't know what I would have done in that situation, and I am not trying to pick the stuffing out of Marco here, okay? That is not what I'm trying to do here, people. I don't want hate mail. But what I'm saying is that it changed a lot of how things were done. It was like, we need to get rid of the 800s. We need to get rid of this front end dependency. And the change, we went to a full 1,000 cc's, and we sort of ushered in the idea of spec tires. That's a fundamental change to our racing. Just like there was a fundamental change to Formula One with Senna and Ratzenberger deaths in Imola in 94.
Yep.
So there's that. So what I think there were, or Tommy Zawa, it was a issue where he wound up hit by another motorcycle at San Marino, right? Yep. What did they do there at San Marino? That track goes backwards now from where it used to be. Okay. So that's a fundamental change that they said, well, we got to do this as a safety measure. I'm trying to think of the Japanese rider at Suzuka who the throttle stuck and he died.
Okay. Kato.
Who was it, Rich?
It was, I'm trying to think of his first name. It was Kato or Kato.
Kato. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So what happened there? Fundamental shift away from a great racetrack to Motegi because they couldn't make Suzuka safe enough. For the bike.
Dajiro Kato. Dajiro Kato.
Very good, Rich.
2003. Yeah.
Dennis Noyes has said this. The only racetrack that technically is safe enough to handle the 200-mile-an-hour speeds of a modern MotoGP motorcycle is Qatar and Doha. Because after that kilometer straight, there's acres. of gravel to slow that motorcycle down. So I think we agree that there should be an age limit. The question is, where is the age limit? I think it's easy to set it to say, look, if you can drive a car legally, then you could be able to race professionally legally. And by professionally, I mean the high-end CEV in Spain, the national series in Britain, right? For us here in America, it'd be like Moto America, which that's true because you've got to be 16 to be able to do that. So I don't think that's too much of a stretch to install that part of it. I think the FIM is going to have to look at it and say, well, if you're there, then by 18, you can come here. Now, I believe that they did that in Formula One because Max Verstappen showed up and he was like 17 in that car.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, nope, no more. You got to be 18 after this. So you have that. Now, Max might be a little different story and everybody is different, but still they saw the potential problem and nipped it right away.
And the point is, Jim, if they bring in a rule like this, then okay, sure, people will bitch and moan about it for a while, but it's the same for everybody. And if they could equalize it across, the main domestic series of say 16, which is kind of an aggregate kind of age between when people can vote or drive or take a beer in a pub or whatever, and say 18 on the world stage, I think that would be reasonable. And it doesn't impinge anybody's career because everybody is affected by it in the same way. And it just allows a bit more maturity to come into it, because I don't want to, I'm not being flippant about this, and but it's kind of, we're at risk of, this Supersport 300 and Moto 3 and certainly the domestic kind of lightweight series, whether they're still running 125s or if they're on kind of Moto 3 kind of machinery, it kind of starting to feel a little bit like the Hunger Games, where each division or whatever they're called in that film, each country kind of pays tribute with these youngsters and they battle it out and some of them don't make it. And it's a bit distasteful what's going on now. And I think because of all the factors that we've been discussing here, And the fact that we're seeing more of these nasty accidents happening, clearly something is going on and something needs to be done. And it's beholden upon the governing body, I think, to step in and take action.
Okay.
Before they're forced to.
Yep, I agree. I'm going to throw this out here as a potential change for the lower level classes, not MotoGP, Moto 3, but Moto 3 CEV National Series. How about an air restrictor at the carburetor? Or the fuel throttle body. Let's put a restrictor in there. Let's limit the power down and give these kids a little bit more of a smoother bike, a little slower bike that they have to deal with. I don't think that's really too bad there at all. So I think we've done as much as we can, Rich, with this. I think we should hear from what the good doctor has to say.
I agree.
So we'll listen to her next. Hey, Motor Potters, it's Jim with another Jim Corner interview. With me again is Dr. Claire McDowell, and we're going to discuss, should 12-year-old, 13, 14-year-olds be allowed to race 130-mile-an-hour motorcycles? This is all based on the article by Matt Oxley, where we're told yet again that another young racer has lost his life. This time it's Hugo Milan, who was killed at Aragon a couple of weeks ago in a CEV race. And 3 years ago, there was a 14-year-old named Andreas Perez, who was also killed at Aragon. This is becoming a bit of a topic, and we thought we'd kind of cover it and get sort of a medical side of it to see what we know or don't know or should we do about it. So, Claire, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I appreciate you coming on and talking about this again. So just for the people who may not have been around for the very first interview that we did, could you just give us your credentials again?
Sure. I am a pediatrician and have been since 2006. So I am a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I am a board certified pediatrician. So I see children from newborns of age.
So these kids being 12, 13, 14 year olds would be something that you'd see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So the first question is, and I know what your answer is going to be, is should a 12, a 13, or a 14-year-old be allowed to race a 130-mile-an-hour motorcycle?
It's a strong, strong negative.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're definitely in the negative camp on that one.
Yes.
I am myself kind of split on this one, mainly from the standpoint of, for me, I was racing bikes at a young age, definitely not doing the speed that these kids were doing, but still doing it. Now, again, motorcycling is an inherently dangerous type of thing that we're seeing and allowing kids to participate in. But I guess the question that I have is, from a medical standpoint, if a kid is 13, 14 years old, from a cognitive reactionary being able to see what's happening in front of them, make decisions in split second times, are they capable, or is the brain still developing that piece?
Yeah, it's absolutely still developing. Teenagers continue to develop in their brains until they're 18 and 19 years of age. So if we're asking 12, 13, 14 year olds to make split decisions when they're going, you know, 130 miles per hour, I think it's just way beyond the ability of a kid at that age. We don't even let 12, 13, and 14 year olds in the United States drive a car. So asking that age of a kid to be able to make quick decisions and to be able to judge safety of corners or how close they are to somebody is just really out of what they're able to do. Even when we talk about teenagers and making good decisions, they can't even make good decisions to not use marijuana or to drink and then drive. So, and that's just part of all of that abstract thinking. They just don't think about consequences of actions. And that really is not fully developed until they're into their college ages. And I'm not saying they can't be on a motorcycle safely, but going at that speed is just really beyond what they should be and what they are capable of. And I have kids that I see who are racing that are part of my practice, but it's definitely not at that echelon. So they're not at that level. They're not going at that speed.
Okay. So let's make this parallel to like cars. Here in the United States, I think, depending on what state it is, like you can be as young as 14 and be behind the wheel of a car. You can be, I think here it can be 15. You can have to have a parent right with you in the front seat. And you're basically helping your child to learn how to drive a car, which is easy because you have a person sitting on the other side of you that can be another set of eyes, see oncoming traffic, see things that we know to look for that the new driver doesn't know how to see. Mm-hmm. But you still have someone here who is taking on a vehicle that is fast. I mean, most used cars are within range of most kids or parents are going to buy a used car. Most of today's cars that you're going to buy can easily go over 100 miles an hour. So are we talking, is that a great parallel to each other? Like is as the age of driving a good equivalency, do you think?
I think that it really depends. Driving age just depends on states, and that largely is dependent on, you know, if they're needed in a farming community. So in rural areas, kids are allowed to start driving at least temps and sometimes even licenses as early as 14 and 15. I grew up in Alaska, and we were allowed to start driving with our temps at age 14. Again, there's not very many people. So the chances of collisions and accidents are going to be a lot less just because there's not as many people in the area. If you're in a larger city or a more populated state, that's when you get into more problems because there's more people and you have interstates where people are going faster. So that's why the ages of those are a little bit higher in those areas. And I think trying to compare motorcycle racing, where you're actually racing someone on a track, is much different than cars. If you think about the car safety features that we have, there's side airbags, there's front airbags, there's backseat airbags, and you have somebody in the car as a temp driver for these teenagers who are giving you instruction for at least 6 months, typically, before they're even allowed to sit for a driver's license. Now, I know with motorcycles racing, they're doing classes, but they don't have somebody sitting right beside them doing instructions as they're racing. So I think that the comparison safety-wise is just too different to even compare. I mean, aside from helmets in a motorcycle race, which are absolutely imperative, and you have some padding for the kidneys and you have some padding on the legs, there's really not a lot of protective gear for these kids. And, you know, you don't have Hans devices when you're riding a motorcycle. So you don't have the ability
to
have
an airbag. I mean, their suits do blow out. They have G's sensors that do understand that there's a crash happening, and they do inflate to support your collarbone, to support your neck area, your chest, to help that impact. And we've seen guys taking 51 G's in those suits on a MotoGP level, right? So
right.
There is, let's put it this way, safety has improved massively in motorcycle racing since the beginning. And where we are today with the helmets, the boots, the leathers, the gloves, airbags is significantly farther ahead, just as safety in a car has changed from a lap belt to a three-point belt to airbags to where crumple zones that we have today. I guess what I'm looking at is I'm trying to draw the parallel that, hey, if you're going to let a person take on this car and drive and take in everything that's happening there and make a decision with it, is it okay to say that's the age that we should let these kids start to race these kind of motorcycles?
I think it's more reasonable to allow like a 16-year-old to be able to do that rather than a 12 or 13 year old. But, you know, keep in mind those 16 year old brains are still developing too. So to be able to make those, you know, quick decisions in emergency situations is still going to be impaired compared to an adult. So I think that you can make an argument for that age a little bit more clear than a 12, 13 or 14 year old.
So like what Rich and I were thinking is okay. You know, in the UK where Rich is, kids can drink at 18, drive at 18 because they're 18. They get their learner's permits at like 17. They, you know, again, have courses and study. We're thinking that that's just a reasonable age that we could say, you know, this is where you start at. Like, you shouldn't be at a world championship level until you're 18 years old. If we were to institute that policy to the FIM and we said, you know, they said, hey, it's 18. Sort of following along with what Formula One did. Max Verstappen came in at 17, and then they immediately said, nope, nobody gets in a Formula One car until they're 18 years old. Is that a better idea? Has the brain developed more by the time, instead of being 16, has it developed more to being at 18? Is it a significantly big jump, or is it just minor?
No.
What's going on there in the brain?
So, I mean, it's just more and more, you know, cognitive development. And so the abstract thinking, the ability to make decisions without the impulsivity, not thinking about consequences, it's just better. I mean, the longer that you wait, the better it is. So waiting until 18, definitely better than a 16-year-old.
Okay, so let's go at it from this standpoint. Is there anything to be gained physically, like body development specifically? I mean, you know, a lot of kids, they're my, what's the term? Is it pre-pubescent? Okay, yeah. And then you hit puberty, you gain weight, you gain muscle, you gain strength. I'm assuming it would be advantageous to go that way.
So it depends, boys versus girls, because pubertal development and overall growth development is different between boys and girls. So with girls, they're really finishing growing by the time they're ages 15 to 16. So that's when growth plates are closing and they've really reached their maximum height. For boys, it happens later. So they're growing until they're 18 or 19 years of age. So that's when their growth plates are starting to fuse and they're not going to have any more growth. So if you're having an accident when you're age 15 or 16, it could definitely affect your growth. Even younger, it's even more of a challenge. So that's really the ages for pubertal development that will affect them. And, you know, just going back to the overall cognitive development through the teenage years. So this is when there's a lot more just complex thinking that happens with kids, and it just progresses from that early adolescence into the adulthood. So abstract thinking about possibilities or reasoning and figuring out things, developing how they just see the world, and logical operations thinking. So really kind of like problem solving just gets better and better. So that's kind of what you see through those teenage years. I don't know if that helps to kind of think about how that happens through those teenage years.
Yes, that leads me to another thing. These kids are now getting to the point where there's a significant amount of pressure that you see applied to them. They're racing these top-level national series, the idea being that they, by the time they're 14 or 15, there better be a contract in a drawer somewhere with their name on it to say that they're going to ride with Grassini, or they're riding with Tech 3, or they're going to ride for IO, or they're going to have some big budget money sponsorship, because the parents are hoofing the bill, so they're putting this pressure onto the kids. Is that, one, what would that pressure do to a 12, 13-year-old? Is that going to really, is it so they can't comprehend it and they don't realize it, or is it adding something to the mix that clouds judgment?
So it really depends on the kid. So if you have a kid who's more prone to mental health disturbances, think about the pressure of that type of money and that type of performance requirements that would be on a kid who can't handle it. So think about increased risk of anxiety, depression, even suicidal ideations could happen. Some kids don't struggle with that, so you may not see that, but it certainly is a potential. And we certainly see increasing rates of mental health disease and disorders in teenagers just from the stress of life. So if you add that on top of it, that would be a really big stress to add on top of just normal life for a kid.
Okay, so if you're stressed, that impairs your ability to react or to function, because your brain is now occupied by things that it shouldn't be. Like, clarity is important in a motorcycle race.
Right.
Michael Andretti's wife in IndyCar always had the saying that Michael went to racer's planet before he got into the car. He went into this area of like zen, calm, quiet. He mentally prepared to get into this car that can go 200 miles an hour or so. If we allow that pressure on top of it, are these kids not able then to get into that zen zone, do you think, from it? I mean, I guess that's more of a psychological question, but I'm going to ask you anyway, because I don't have anybody else to ask.
It's really, that's an abstract thinking. So it depends on the development of the kids. Some kids, I think, are going to be able to do that. Some kids would have no idea what to do. If you even think about kids who are like taking exams or taking ACT tests or SAT tests, they can struggle with just performance anxiety just from testing. So think about that on a hugely higher, more dangerous level, and the stress that they can come under from that. I don't know if you can make a comparison there, but we're just asking a whole lot of these kids.
So it could be that we're asking too much of them.
Yeah.
But if we step back and say, look, you can get on one of these bikes at national level if you're 16. Now we have them until they're 16, 17, maybe an 18-year-old at a national series, and then they're getting maybe a wild card at 18 into the world championship. That is a more in line development with the actual development of the brain then, right? Because we're not rushing someone in at 14. We're letting them progress more naturally. Would you agree?
I think that's a better idea.
It's a better idea. Okay. Yeah. So, all right. So my thought was, I kind of thought this to Rich, spit this out to Rich at the very end when we were talking about this, was that, look, we got something that goes 130 miles an hour for this 12-year-old, because I think you can be 12 in some of the nations in Europe, sometimes in Asia, they're allowed to be 12. But they're getting basically this, you know, maybe a year or two older Moto 3 bike, which are still very fast, very capable motorcycles. What if we put in an air restrictor into these things in the throttle bodies so they can't go that fast? So we slow the bike down to meet maybe where their requirement is. I think roughly, I think a Moto 3 bike puts out about 60 horsepower. If you put an air restrictor in there, you could cut it down to make maybe, you know, let's call it maybe 40 horsepower to start with. And then, you know, maybe as you, maybe you have a class of kids that's 12, 13 are on roughly a, let's call it a 40 horsepower bike. And then you could get in between maybe a bigger, slightly bigger restrictor, a little more speed, a little more power, and just ease them into this progress instead of just dumping them on something that's just bullet fast. That's got to be better for them, I would think, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, progression, I know a lot of kids start riding bikes when they're 4, 5, 6 years old. That I'm not saying that that's dangerous, right, to start at that age, but you just have to do it safely. And you start small and you go slow. And you have to make sure your kids are making good decisions when they come up to, you know, a dangerous part in their track, or when they're riding with somebody else and they can avoid collisions. So that's what you've really got to be aware of as they're getting older. But I think a restriction to limit the speed would help significantly. You don't want those kids going 120 or 130 miles an hour. And if you think about it too, an adult in a car, a lot of them can't handle 120 or 130 miles an hour in a car. So let's give them some time.
So as I see it, the way you're looking at it is that we need, that you agree that, you know, we really need to take these bikes away from the 12, 13, 14 years old. We need to go back to a more, let's call it a slower bike, either with a restrictor, less horsepower, something like that. Have a more progressive path that allows them to ramp up along with their mental capacity, their analytical thinking, the other stresses that are involved in all of this, to get to where they can easily make that transition into the world stage. I mean, there's got to be an element of stress too, is you're flying around the world doing this. Like, I think of Pedro Acosta, he's 16 and he's literally running around the world. Well, racing a motorcycle.
You have to think about, you know, I'm assuming somebody's watching their nutrition, right. But
yes, are he they isn't there out? By himself. That's
right. Are they drinking enough water? Are they getting enough sleep?
You're talking about nutrition.
Nutrition, right. Are they eating what they need to be eating? Are they drinking enough water? Are they getting 9 to 10 hours of sleep? Are they allowed time to rest? Do they have brain rest time where they can just relax and enjoy being a teenager? Or are they like pushed at, you know, every second they have available? Who's watching their exercise? Because these kids at 16 are not yet physically even developed yet to be doing full weightlifting. Somebody should be watching that. So there's a lot of other things that go into that just besides being able to get on a bike and go fast.
Okay. Well, I think that pretty much gets it. It's really not a whole lot more that I want to know about, other than, you know, from a physical standpoint, and just kind of get your recommendations and feel about how they would develop if we changed the rules and what would it amount to. So appreciate it. Thank you for the time, Doctor, as always.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks to the good doctor for that brilliant insight into the psychology, physicality of what, 12, 13, 14 years may be going through. Rich, it is the weekend. It is Austria. It is the 1 year anniversary of the miracle. So, what are we going to look for this weekend? I'll start it off real quick. Moto 3. I want to see if the teams can actually back time properly in qualifying, so everybody gets a fast lap.
Well, we had a miracle last year. Let's see if there's a miracle this year in terms of, managing to get a lap out. before the clock runs out.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the biggest thing there. With Moto 2, I'm going to be interested to see if we see if it's still going to be a Remy Raul battle out front. I'm going to wonder, is the pack is going to be spread out or not? We've seen a lot of races here lately where the Moto 2 pack stretches out. This track's fast. The draft is there. Are we going to see a little bit more pack racing? That kind of thing. I'm interested to look at that. And I'm looking to see if Lowe's can maybe reset his brain and get up there and challenge the top two guys.
Yeah, I think Gardner and Fernandez is likely to be business as usual. For me, as you said, Lowe's and Bezzecchi, I think, can they start to make inroads in the second half of the season?
Yep, we'll see what happens there. Finally, MotoGP. He's had 5 weeks off. It's a track that has very few turns and must Ken... Mark Marquez do anything with Quartararo at a track that's fast, like, and flowing like this? I don't
know.
Yeah,
and it's a Ducati track, and KTM home turf, so it's going to be fierce, I think. Yeah, it's going to be although, looking at the weather forecast, it doesn't look very promising this weekend.
Rain, the great equalizer, I love it.
The rain might be coming. Ooh. So
if it's a wet, dry race, I'm putting my money on Marquez.
Yeah, and Oliveira, I mean, you know, he had a win there last year.
Yep. All right. So I think there's a lot of good things that we can look at for this weekend. Everybody, I want you to enjoy it, and we'll get talk to you after the weekend. Thank you.